Welcome to Crypto Nights, where we help you finally make sense of the trending world of cryptocurrencies. So gather your virtual piggy bank and let's get started.
Hey, Mark, welcome to Crypto Nights. So excited to have you on our episode as a guest speaker. Why don't we start off with a brief introduction to you and your background?
Sure, and thanks for having me on. I've been a technologist basically all my life since I sold my first little video game at the age of 10, and I've been in and out of games and other technologies ever since, and I've built and sold a few companies, some in games, some in other industries, and like everybody else, I became interested in crypto kind of with the emergence of Bitcoin, and, you know, did some early mining and, you know, lost some of the Bitcoin I mined, and, you know, like everybody else. But as a real kind of business and kind of process opportunity, it wasn't obvious to me exactly where the long-term value was. And so I didn't kind of get into the industry for a while. With the emergence of kind of ICOs as a process, it kind of became clear to me where I can add value, because by nature, I'm kind of a plumber. You know, if there's going to be a gold rush, I'm not going to be the guy standing, you know, ankle deep in freezing cold water, panning for gold. I'm going to be selling jeans. It's just, you know, that's my nature. And those are all the companies I've built over the years, have all been sort of infrastructure companies. And so ICOs were finally the area where I realized some real infrastructure is required. And very early on, you know, a year ago or more at this point, it became clear to me that these ICOs were going to be securities, you know, and at the time, that was not a very popular view of things. And, you know, KYC was just another three-letter acronym that nobody knew what it meant. But having been in business for a long time, you know, to me, it was obvious that this was going to be how things were headed. So, you know, I sort of put on my hat and gathered up some smart friends around me and said, okay, let's just assume, fast forward, let's assume the euphoria passes and people do realize that long-term these things need to be securities. What is the infrastructure that is missing from the ICO as it is currently, you know, April, March of 2017 envisioned in order to make these things real? You know, and I'll give you a great example, right? So we all know the sacredness of the wallet, right? If I lose my wallet password, then suddenly I've lost access to all my tokens and, you know, I'm pretty much weeping in the aisles. Well, you know, if you fast forward and you assume that this token is actually security, it represents a share in a business, then by law, right, if I lose my share certificate, it doesn't mean that I use my rights as a shareholder, right? I'm still your shareholder and you still need to deal with me. So as an issuer, as a business, as a company, I need to have a solution for that. And the ERC-20 token does nothing today to help you with that problem. And in fact, it kind of goes the opposite way and says, you know, whoever holds this thing is actually the rightful owner. And that may not even be true because shares can have restrictions on transfer and all those kinds of things. So essentially what I've been focused on for the last year is creating and finding solutions for all of the misalignments between kind of the crypto ICO euphoric kind of business as it has emerged and the actual long-term needs. And, you know, I've been on the soapbox since August talking to people about it. And the first 6 months, people ignored me. And then, you know, for the next couple of months, it was, okay, we understand what you're talking about now, but why? And then, you know, literally since kind of late January, early February, the conversation has nicely transitioned to how. So it's been kind of an interesting transition for me. And I'm excited that actually the world is sort of catching up in this view that these things really do need to be treated more thoughtfully.
Oh my goodness. I'm just so excited because our primary purpose is to bring some sense and sensibility to this whole craziness around the ICOs. As exciting as these are as a new technology, but I think the fundamental one being blockchain and this whole ICO being one use case on the blockchain. And you said it right. I mean, if it smells like a security, looks like a security, it is a security. It was just a matter of time before SEC, because they have been doing their stuff in democratizing. When we saw AngelList, we saw the Jobs Act, you know, jumpstart our business startup, I think May of 2016 or something, whenever it came out. But the point is, so it was kind of going in the direction. Now we're trying to bypass that. Ain't going to happen, you know, just because you call it a utility token. Jay Clayton came out recently and said, hey, I don't care what you call them. If you're investing in them with the intent that they'll go up in value and will be traded on an exchange, they will be treated as securities.
Well, I think there's also a fundamental business model issue with the way ICOs are structured. Because, you know, if we imagine that I have, you know, the haircut ICO, right? I can't price a haircut in haircut tokens if the underlying value of the haircut token keeps going up, right? It's called, in the real world, we call that rampant inflation, right? If my haircut costs one haircut token and that haircut token literally is worth $10 today and $20 tomorrow and $50 the next week, the underlying value of a haircut hasn't changed. So that means that I need to constantly change the price at which I give haircuts if I give those haircuts in haircut tokens, right? So that doesn't even function as an economy. Forget about the fact that it's actually security.
Very good. Excellent. And you're also telling me a little bit about that hit by a bus idea. Can you elaborate that a little bit?
Sure. So yeah, you know, along with this notion of I lose access to my tokens, there's a whole set of requirements in the real world that have to do with what happens with these tokens. So yeah, me losing my password is one scenario. But another scenario is, you know, if I'm hit by a bus tomorrow, you know, my wife and kids are the beneficiaries of my estate. So they now own whatever it is that I owned. And somehow that needs to be taken care of, right? Again, the company can't say, well, that's none of my business. If you locked out of your wallet, then, you know, tough on you, because that's just not going to work. That's not how our laws work. And that's true of putting things in trusts for kids. That's true of all sorts of kind of capabilities. You know, anytime someone goes through a divorce and there's a court order that says, you know, half your assets are now your spouse's assets, the company needs to be able to respond to that court order. It can't say, well, you know, sorry, you got to track down your husband and beat the password out of him, right? Like that doesn't work. It's still a problem for the issuer. It's not that that real companies in the real world can say, I'm sorry, I can't help solve this problem for you, court order notwithstanding. It's still going to be on the issuer to fix it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So as a result, and so I see you starting to elaborate some serious infrastructural problems in the way ICOs are conducted, designed, executed before, during, after, and all of that, and then how they sit legally. And you being the one that provides the pickaxes and the shovels kind of a person, the mindset being is, hey, you guys do the gold rush, I'll enable you.
Right. Yeah. So we're building our company effectively as a software as a service company so that we can get our technology built onto the inside of of ICO issuers, right? So we can, you know, Token IQ, we make smarter tokens so that your security token can actually have these capabilities, right? So this kind of notion of the long-term functionality of it is just one. You know, another kind of structural shortcoming of the ICO economy right now is that there's no kind of inherent mechanism for market making, right? So we know from real world securities that we need mechanisms like options in order for market makers to be able to create markets and, you know, in some way help control the flow and control the volatility of the price, right, by making these options possible. So, you know, we can do things like allow options to be done right inside the tokens themselves, as opposed to having to do it outside the token in kind of in an exchange mechanism that is sort of external to the smart contract. Because from my perspective, that's kind of solving the next generation problem with the last generation solution, right? It doesn't actually take advantage of the opportunities afforded by blockchain in order to recreate or, you know, build new versions of these mechanisms that we know we need in place. So we can do things like options. We can do things like swaps. We can do things like vesting, right? You come work for a new company, that company can give you 100,000 tokens, but they vest over 4 years. They're locked into your wallet until they're vested. And if you leave, you know, the ones that haven't vested can be zipped back by the company. All right. Those kind of capabilities don't exist in ICOs today, but they need to, because that's how remuneration and employee retention works. So those are the kind of things that we do.
You always looked at the blockchain related or token related stuff and said, hey, we have been, don't come in as if we have zero history. We have lived a life when there are these exchanges and stock markets, and there are reasons for these options and swaps and all of these and vesting. So there are all these things that came in because of real human needs over time. You can't suddenly come in and say, hey, technological capabilities restrict us from doing all these things that you human beings need. You have to adapt. No, that's not going to happen. You're saying, hey, let's take this cool new technology and add enough design into it so that they actually are backward compatible to human needs.
Well, yeah, that's exactly it. So, you know, really, it's kind of aligning with the expectations of the other 99.7% of humanity, right? So that's true as much for regulators and legislators as it is for the customers, right? You know, people view these things in the context that they understand. And, you know, this is kind of a philosophical disagreement I sometimes have with, you know, real kind of crypto purists, right? But I actually think that change that is kind of gradual and change that is transformational over time is better than, you know, this kind of revolutionary, you know, hit on a dime kind of change that leaves most of humanity behind. We need to kind of educate, you know, the listeners' moms and, you know, grandmothers about how to deal with cryptocurrency. And there's a set of kind of built-in assumptions around how the world works that we need to reconcile this economy with if it's going to be accepted, because otherwise it will not be accepted and it'll be regulated out of existence. And it's, you know, it doesn't need to be a battle. You know, I have a story I love to share. When I was a teen, my grandmother lived with me, and I had a stepsister in another country, and my stepsister got access to a fax machine. So I told my grandmother about fax machines, and she happily wrote a letter, and I sent the fax to my stepsister, and I came back and I said, okay, grandma, you know, I sent the fax. She should get it, you know, any moment now. And my grandmother looked at the letter that she wrote that I'm holding in my hand and heard every word I said and said, why is it still here? Right? So sometimes it, you know, you need to fit new capabilities into existing metaphors or into kind of existing use cases for them to be truly understood. And the reason we have these laws, whether you agree with them or not, is because they are all based on a lot of tiers. You know, we have these restrictions and we have these regulations and we have these requirements because a lot of people have lost a lot of money over and over again, and it's not good for the society. It's not good for the economy, right? So whenever I, you know, have an argument with somebody who is not maybe as worldly or as experienced, and they tell me that, you know, the best part about crypto is this kind of, you know, economic anarchy element of it, you know, when they've grown up in the US or they've grown up in Hong Kong or they've grown up in Australia, where they're, you know, sitting on the benefit of 350 years of British common law, right? I sort of need to remind them, you know, talk to somebody who lived through the Venezuelan meltdown or the Soviet meltdown or, you know, somewhere in Africa during their economic kind of crises, and then tell me how good economic anarchy is, right? We need controls. We need people to be able to have a sense of what to expect for economic systems to flourish. Otherwise, they do collapse.
Fantastic. And you're kind of, to draw a different analogy, Geoffrey Moore wrote a book many years ago called Crossing the Chasm. It's almost like there is these early adopters, these crazy people, these rebels, this you know, cutting edge technologists and all of that. I think we're kind of, that's the initial 1%, if you will. And then suddenly this whole, I call it backward compatibility, you know, the humanization of this technology becomes important, because we suddenly want people to use it on a mass scale. And it's like my favorite thing about, you know, the cell phone came to the fore, and then suddenly they realized for human beings to use it, we need a charger. Actually, that should come along with the phone, you know?
Sure. Yeah, exactly.
So there's something called a complete product that he talks about in Crossing the Chasm, if I remember my book right. So, and So that's what this chasm is. Suddenly you need to think about usability, legalities, compliance, and safety, and things like that. And I think what you literally did in Token IQ, if I'm understanding the intent, is you identified the chasm to begin with. And because you started looking at it with an X-ray vision slightly differently than the rest, because you were a lot like, I'm going to launch my next ICO. It's more like, if ICOs have to become adopted across the board to the Joe and Mary out there, how do they need to look? And then that different question made you look at it differently from a sideways angle and come up with this whole bunch of new ideas that you're now incorporating into software as a service Token IQ.
Correct.
You didn't say ICO, you said software as a service, which means you're building a platform. It's almost like you're building the airport or the runway where the other planes can take off from your runway. So you're building that rather than you being a plane yourself. Did I get your intent right?
That's exactly right. Yeah. So we are building the infrastructure to enable issuers to issue, let's call them ICOs, but also to enable, let's think of them as more traditional companies to tokenize themselves. And finally, an on-ramp essentially for maybe what you might think of as incumbent companies to allow them to become on-ramps for masses of people onto this kind of cryptocurrency universe, right? So what I mean by that is, there's already all sorts of investment managers and brokerages and RIAs and, right, mutual fund companies that have relationships with investors, and have the trust of the other 99.7% of the population. So helping those people become on-ramps for the people that they help and represent, as opposed to, kind of being the evil other that we need to, sort of steal customers from, I think is also a much more valuable transformational tool, right? I'm not really interested in going to war with Wells Fargo, right? Wells Fargo has done the hard work of KYCing all their customers. Let's find a way to allow Wells Fargo to then represent that KYC identity to the crypto universe so that the KYC is automatically done and is not suddenly a barrier to entry. Because, real people don't want to send their driver's license off to somebody via email. It's just not high on their priority list of things that they want to do before dinner. How many issuers are you going to send a photo of your driver's license to, right? So that sort of stuff is kind of also for us a part of enabling the infrastructure.
Awesome. So I think I'm understanding this whole, and you said something else too in our discussion before the discussion. You said while it is not very popular in the ICO world or in the blockchain world, you have actually patented stuff.
Yeah. So, I've built many tech businesses over the years. And so, my order of operations is always like, find a problem, invent a solution, and then build a company around it. And so as a part of that, of course, we did file a bunch of patents for these kind of capabilities that we thought would be required. That doesn't mean that I'm necessarily going to go out and, chase everybody down and try to sue everybody out of existence. In part, it is also a defensive capability so that other people can't come after me, because, that also happens. I don't think that necessarily using a collaborative approach is counter to having, intellectual property protection. And, as we are witnessing in this Oracle Google fight around Java and Android, if you don't have the intellectual property protection in place, sometimes it can, jump up and bite you in the butt when you least expect it. So that's, definitely is a part of our growth strategy. But, and I know that the crypto world is more focused these days on how do we get this, done collaboratively and open source. But, anybody who doesn't recognize that lots of people are fighting for lots of IP in the space is kidding themselves, because there's dozens and hundreds of patents that have been filed over the last 5-6 years in the blockchain space.
You said it. Absolutely. I'm totally. Again, it's the same thing that you're saying, hey, you can't collective knowledge that's been accumulated over centuries cannot be completely ignored. There's a reason there's a U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. There's a reason why we patent ideas. What is the motivation for inventors if we cannot do that, right?
You know, there's a joke about what experience is. Experience is what you get when you don't get what you want. And, you know, I have, you know, along with my successes, I have plenty of experience. And so, you know, that guides how I build a business, of course.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So can you tell us about the, because I went to your website and it gives actually a brief but very clear explanation about a lot of things that you plan to do and you are doing. But can you shed some light on the timeline? Where are you guys headed? When are you guys headed there? And when can people hope to see something rolled out to the public?
Sure. So we are now in the point where we have, you know, sort of done our internal proof of concepts, and we know how we're building the technology, and we know which change we support because we support more than just ERC-20. We are now essentially kind of working on the rollout phase of this thing. So we are working on, you know, what is our marketing message going to be, and, you know, what colors are we going to use definitely for our logos and, you know, all that sort of stuff, as well as sort of identifying our first 10, 20 kind of customers and partners to do actual real world examples of our stuff being used. Again, maybe for better or for worse, I'm not a huge hype guy. So, you know, I'm a tech guy in my gut. So I focused first on building it. Now I'm focused on, you know, essentially rolling it out and having it used, and then, you know, sort of trumpeting it to the world and building the rest of the business. So we're working with some folks down the path of tokenizing already public companies. We're working with some folks around tokenizing debt issues. We're working with folks around tokenizing, you know, more kind of conventional securities offerings. I'm even talking with Ben Bartlett in Berkeley, who is working on the tokenization of city bonds effectively. So I'm very interested in all of these use cases because to me, they all represent very high value opportunities in that they bring together this notion of the ICO token with real world examples and real world requirements and different rule sets around who can invest and what kind of reporting is required and all of the legal infrastructure that we ultimately need to encode into these smart contracts for this stuff to work properly in a resilient way.
See, given my unique position as a host for a podcast, crypto, understandably, I get a lot of incoming calls and requests about, oh, we are an existing company. We've been around for 3-4 years and we have a real product out there. Now, I get a lot of nonsense stuff, but discounting all of that, there is some real good companies out there that are asking this question, should I go ICO and how should I do it, et cetera, et cetera. And when I see a lot of the things that you kind of done a factored thinking of all the important elements for them ahead of time, and you're building them out as a service. So
those are actually the guys I'm looking for right now, is the guys who have gotten into their head that they want to kind of enter this environment and now are trying to understand how to do it, you know, responsibly and effectively. And, you know, with various, you know, partners in legal and in kind of process and us on the technology, you know, we have created pipelines that we believe can actually get these companies out there successfully in a compliant way. And so this is exactly the stage where we're at now, is we are working with the first few. And, you know, I would definitely invite anybody who is kind of in that mind space to contact us, because that's actually exactly where we're at in the evolution of our business.
I might do that. I actually have a couple of companies in mind as I'm talking to you. Now, having said that, I have two more questions.
Sure.
I'll hand it over to you. One is, I mean, this is a lot of effort. How long have you been at it, and how did you fund it, and who is the team behind it?
So I've been at this for about a year now, not counting, you know, the 40 years of related experience I'm sitting on top of, which of course means that by the crypto economy standards, I'm a little older than most. And right now we have essentially a group of very smart folks who are helping in kind of a contract basis from around the world, literally just, you know, because I've gone out and found, you know, the brilliant people wherever they are. But as an operating business, we're building it in Phoenix, Arizona. Phoenix, Arizona is not necessarily the place that you think of as being, you know, a San Francisco-like or Austin-like hotbed of new tech. But actually, Phoenix has some interesting things going for it. In particular, there's a lot of fintech software development that happens here, including some very large companies like American Express that do a lot of the software development here in Phoenix. So there's a lot of very experienced folks. A lot of people who built, you know, payment systems and who worry about things like PCI and security and compliance and write code that worries about other people's money. The other thing that's fun about Arizona is we were the first state to pass a law that gave digital contracts the same force of law as paper contracts. So although Arizona, you know, is not necessarily on anyone's list of super forward-thinking tech states at the moment, you know, I definitely, you know, trying to help change that. But particularly in the crypto space, there's a lot of pretty active thinking going on in the state. And, you know, I'm very happy and proud to be a part of it.
Wow. And has it been traditional? Have you self-funded it or is it traditionally funded like angel VC funding?
Right. So I've been fortunate enough to have several exits in my professional career. So heretofore, it's been personally funded. And where we're at right now is that we are transitioning to a more external funding cycle. We are going to be focused, or we are focused on traditional equity funding. As I said, we're not really in the business of doing our own ICO, in part because we are still trying to understand our own regulatory footprint. Depending on how we engage with customers, we could potentially become a money transmitter. We could potentially become a fund. We could potentially become a broker. So for us, it's a very careful dance of trying not to accidentally walk into any regulatory requirements that we're not aware of. And I feel like doing an ICO today would actually just complicate that process as opposed to going with investment from, you know, sophisticated, mature professional investors, let's call it. We are, as I said, trying to help others do their ICOs, and we will probably ultimately hold some kind of a public offering to allow people to invest in the projects that we're working with, either ourselves or in conjunction with somebody else. And we are in some discussions with other folks who maybe we will jointly work with on that. But in the short and medium term, we're focused on more traditional fundraising to now, you know, expand the business from kind of the startup phase to the more kind of mid-cycle operating phase.
Fascinating. So I'm for sure we as Crypto Knights will be not only in touch with you, come back to you as you launch your software as a service platform. And I can even envision us doing three-way calls between you and the companies that you're taking ICO, those founders.
Yeah, that'd be fun. That'd be great.
Very excited about that and wish you all the best. And before we wrap up, Mark, are there questions I should have asked, but I did not?
You know, I think one of the questions that people often ask is about geography and kind of our geographic focus and understanding sort of what, you know, it's fine that we talk about the SEC, but the SEC is not the only regulator in the world. And we're trying to build these, you know, ICOs are theoretically international by nature. So the answer, I guess, that I'd like to share with you on that front is that we have a couple of different capabilities around the geography. So first is one of the capabilities that we provide is the ongoing and never-ending ability to geographically constrain participation. So, you know, a lot of ICOs lately have gone through the process of, you know, taking people's IDs and then, you know, if you're in the US, they won't sell to you, okay? But the reality is if they sell to someone who's not in the US and then that share gets sold to, or that token gets sold to someone who is in the US, they still end up with a US investor, right? Whereas with us, because we can enforce kind of ongoing requirements throughout the life cycle of the token, we can actually help you constrain your geography to what you as the issuer decide is in your best business interest. But the other thing that's kind of philosophically different about our approach is that, you know, unlike, again, it's hard to think of something that's been around for 9 months as traditional, but unlike traditional ICOs, we have the ability to modify the rules under which the contract enforces those restrictions. So as the rules change, as legislation changes in various territories, we can continue to update that. And, you know, again, a lot of kind of more traditional kind of crypto purists point to that as a liability and as a weakness. But from my point of view, you know, within the construct of the law, right, we rely on these companies to execute what they promise to us in their releases and in their filings and so on. And this is no different, right? We have mechanisms in place for how we deal with companies who are malfeasant. We sue them, right? So we look to our regulators to punish them. This is kind of, you know, again, along the lines of encoding ongoing kind of infrastructure into this new token economy. This is an important piece of what we do, is we try to align those expectations and those capabilities so that issuers don't end up locked out of their own sort of token environment, which happens today. You know, I don't know if you've ever looked at wallet 000 on the Ethereum blockchain, but there's, last time I checked, there was $800 million worth of value in wallet zero that has been lost forever, right?
Oh my God.
And this is the kind of thing that in the real world, in the real economy, can never be allowed to happen. Because, you know, if we imagine that our token economy now represents, you know, 3% or 2% or whatever of the overall economic value of investment in the world, can you imagine if that 800 million becomes 80 billion or 800 billion because we maintain the same ratio? I mean, that would be an unthinkable outcome for me.
It's beyond insane. I totally agree with you. Wow. Well, and this may or may not be a, you may not be ready to answer this yet, but is there a pricing for this software as a service that's that you can talk publicly about? Or is it something still in works?
Yeah, that's something that we're still refining. So I'm probably not really ready to talk about in a public sense. But, you know, our model definitely is kind of a software as a service model, where there's a licensing fee up front, and then there's an ongoing small fee per shareholder, per, you know, token holder, for kind of operating the platform on an ongoing basis.
Awesome. Wish you all the best. Thank you for joining us, Mark. This has been extremely illuminating, and we look forward to more having you on as a guest on many more episodes in the future.
Thank you. Thank you for your time, and a pleasure speaking with you, and looking forward already to the next time.
Thanks for listening to the Crypto Knights. Never miss an episode. Subscribe now at www.cryptonights.io.